A group of prosecutors challenged the Stand Your Ground law, and a 27-year-old murder may finally be solved. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN on this Halloween. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle is leading a group of prosecutors against the Stand Your Ground law. They claim it's unconstitutional, but will the state Supreme Court listen? Also, the highly rated podcast Felonious Florida from the Sun Sentinel looks at a decades-old murder that took place in Wellington, and it involved a clown. And Wynwood Yard is likely to be out of Wynwood within the next year, but was it inevitable? Does new development threaten the cultural lifeblood of Miami's neighborhoods? Finally, the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival celebrates more than three decades of bringing unique film and culture to the region. How has it grown over the years, and what sort of taste do film lovers have in South Florida? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and we are at the WLRN studios in the Miami Herald in Doral today. Well, a group of prosecutors led by Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle believes that the current Stand Your Ground law is unconstitutional, and they've approached the Florida Supreme Court to look more closely at it. Also in the news, James Whitey Bulger, Boston gangster played in movies by Jack Nicholson and Johnny Depp, died while in prison this week. Authorities are investigating this as a homicide, but what role did he play in Miami crime? Miami Herald reporter David Avaya joins us now to talk about these stories. David, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Let's start with the Stand Your Ground law. Tell us about this League of Prosecutors. Who are they?
So the League of Prosecutors is a Miami-based organization that encompasses current prosecutors and former prosecutors, and it's a group that's dedicated to an education role for the public, teaching them about the criminal justice system, mentorship, promoting good judgeship, judicial excellence. So it's a local organization, so it's not a statewide one, but they have authored a brief asking the Supreme Court to declare the latest version of the Stand Your Ground law unconstitutional, and Miami-Dade State Attorney Kathy Fernandez-Rundle, who's a member, has signed on to adopt that position, which is a break from the Attorney General's office, which is defending the law in a series of appeals now before the Supreme Court.
And right now, I mean, what's their case? I mean, why now?
Well, ever since the amendment, ever since the law was amended, there's been a host of legal fights just trying to iron it out and figure out exactly how to apply it. So one of the issues is whether it's retroactive. That's actually the main issue up before the Florida Supreme Court as to whether it applies to old cases. And let me just explain what the change is before. The original Stand Your Ground law in 2005 did a couple things, and one of the things is it gave judges an easier path to throwing out a case that they deem as acting in self-defense, so a relatively loose standard. But the Florida Supreme Court ruled that it is the burden of the defendant to put on a case and prove he was acting in self-defense. Okay, what this law did that was passed last year, and which is very vexing for prosecutors, is that it changed the burden on them to disprove that they were not acting in self-defense. So it completely shifted the burden, and all the prosecutors and law enforcement in Florida opposed it at the time, and it still passed anyways. And so they're saying basically this denies us as prosecutors the right to have a jury trial, because it's basically allowing for a trial without a jury by giving the judge this tremendous leeway to throw at a case.
And there were two high-profile shootings this year where Stand Your Ground played a role. Is that had anything to do with this happening now?
No, I mean, these Stand Your Ground cases, self-defense cases, pop up all the time. In the last decade, so no, these cases, actually the cases that are before the Supreme Court, are ones that happened a couple years ago. The one from Miami that's up before the Florida Supreme Court involves a woman who fired at somebody and is charged with attempted murder for an altercation outside a strip club.
Talking with David Ovalle, reporter for the Miami Herald, and talking about the Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Rundell Fernandez recently declaring, with a group, by the way, of other attorneys, declaring that the Florida Stand Your Ground law right now is unconstitutional. They're going to the state Supreme Court. David also recently covered the death of the famous mobster James Whitey Bulger. One of his stories talked about his connection to Miami. So, David, is he tied to a murder in Miami?
Yeah, so you know, obviously everyone who follows crime news and popular culture knows Whitey Bulger as this quintessential Boston mafia figure, mob figure. And but, you know, there was actually a murder down here in Miami perpetrated in 1982. Whitey and some of his top people were told that a gambling executive who was sort of their part of their crew might cooperate against them. And they were actually running a skimming operation down here at World Hi-Li, which, of course, Hi-Li is this, you know, sport that was sort of popular in the 80s and, you know, was out, you know, was in, featured in Miami Vice and, you know, kind of a quintessential Miami 80s thing. And so they dispatched one of their hitmen, and their hitmen picked this John Callahan, who was the executive, up at the airport and shot and killed him immediately, and then left his body in the trunk at MIA. So this murder has been outstanding for many years. Then in 2008, the state actually tried John Connolly, who was the FBI agent in Boston, whose life was loosely depicted in The Departed and also in Black Mass, the movie. And it was a fascinating trial, probably one of the most fascinating trials I've ever covered. Basically, it was a Boston trial with every cast of characters you could imagine from Boston taking a stand, and all these underworld figures you know, basically trying this case, but here in Miami, for the murder of John Callahan.
Would Mr. Bulger have ever faced prosecution in Miami?
You know, it's probably unlikely, because would have been a great expense to the taxpayers to do another trial down here, and he wasn't going to get out in of his federal sentence. He was doing life sentence for at least 11 murders, so he wasn't going to get out. There wasn't any rush to bring him down here, but the case was still technically open, and he was still technically facing the trial for murder. And Connolly, by the way, was convicted in Miami and is now serving a 40-year sentence in Florida prison, state prison.
You know, we think of crime in Miami in the 80s, especially, we think of the cartels, but did any other mob families from the Northeast or anywhere else do business here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Miami's always been Florida has always been a hub for these types of organized crime figures from the Northeast. You know, as you well know, in the 50s and all of that, you know, this was a hotbed for the Italian mafia from the Northeast. And of course, you know, the Boston guys came down here and were doing their business down here as well. All the crazy stories always have a Miami connection, even going back decades.
Well, that's one of those stories that maybe they'll make another movie out of at some point. But we are definitely going to keep our eyes out on the story of, again, the challenge for the Stand Your Ground law as it goes to the court. Do we have any idea when the court might look at it, if they will?
Well, they're definitely going to look at it. It's going to be an ongoing process, and it's going to be months and months in the making. They still have to, you know, get more briefs from other parties involved. I mean, of course, the NRA has the National Rifle Association, which backed the law and is a powerful force in Florida politics, has come out and said it's completely constitutional and should be allowed to remain. And as has the, you know, a lot of prominent gun control groups. While Kathy Rundell, our local state attorney, has come out and adopted the position of this League of Prosecutors, this is not a statewide thing. No other prosecutors in other jurisdictions have signed on to do likewise. I reached out to a couple of them. Dave Ehrenberg, who's the state attorney in Palm Beach, has suggested he may. You know, he hadn't seen the filing until I sent it to him. So there's definitely some support there, but, you know, it's also a politically thorny issue for people, particularly upstate. So, you know, it might not be in the cards for other state attorneys to join in the effort.
Again, we'll keep following that story as you will. David Ovalle, reporter with the Miami Herald. Always a pleasure, man.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, there was a lot of uproar about the closing of the Wynwood Yard. We spoke with the owner, and she wants people to remember they're not closed yet. More on that coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, one of Wynwood's more popular music and food venues will likely be shutting its doors come springtime of next year. The Wynwood Yard is an outdoor event space with food trucks, a stage for live music, and it's hosted film screenings as well as culinary educational programs. The news came in early September that the developer, Wynwood Green, would be purchasing the land where Wynwood Yard and O Cinema currently sit and convert it into apartments, commercial space, and parking. There was a large public outcry to the news that Wynwood was losing some of its important cultural institutions, and it raised an important question. What defines a neighborhood? We talked yesterday with the founder and CEO of Wynwood Yard, Della Hyman, and her message was clear. The yard is still open, and it's thriving with a series of programs planned for the season, including a Halloween party tonight called Wynwood Graveyard. But I began by asking her how she responded to the news that the land was being purchased.
My landlord, David Lombardi, has been super forthcoming with me since really the day that I signed my lease. And basically, you know, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but my original lease at the Wynwood Yard was for 10 months. And so basically what David did was give me an opportunity to test something out in vacant property in a way that really hadn't been done before in Miami. Now, you know, when you look around, you see all of these temporary use projects around the city that involve entertainment spaces and that involve food trucks and some of these common elements. But at the time, there weren't any temporary use projects on vacant land that looked anything like the yard. And David and I really got along. He understood what the vision was, and he gave me an opportunity to lease out the space. And he said, look, see if you can permit it. And if you can't, you know, you can just turn the property back over to me and, you know, all will be fine. And so I was sort of in this bind of trying to figure out how to make it happen, because at that time I had never been into a building department. I didn't understand anything about planning or zoning. I had never pulled a permit. I had never spoken to an architect or an engineer, much less, you know, kind of overseen an entire project start to finish from conceptualization to design to permitting to construction and opening. So it was just this very funny process of me trying to sort of figure out on the back end, after I had already signed a lease, how to get the project open. And it was cumbersome, and I learned a lot, and, you know, it was an interesting process. But David basically said to me at the beginning, I can guarantee you 10 months. At some point, I'm going to sell this property, so I can't give you a long-term lease here.
So he told you ahead of time. We're selling
on
this
day
eventually.
One. Yeah, he's, okay. I mean, he's an amazing person, and I'm so grateful to him for the opportunity. And
so it's been sold.
Well, it's going to be sold.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, my understanding is that Lennar submitted plans to the city, and they've gone through different layers of the process. And I guess, you know, I don't know exactly what the timing is.
I mean,
you
think about what you've accomplished up to this point. What's your reaction to this and the possibility that now it's just going to be built out into something bigger?
So, look, I think that all neighborhoods have their evolution, and, you know, the zoning in Wynwood has changed even since we opened our business there to allow for taller structures to go into that neighborhood. I don't know all the intricacies of it, but I know that there were some zoning changes on the 29th Street corridor. I think that happened after the yard was open. And my understanding is that it's really always been part of the plan to develop that part of the neighborhood and to go vertical. Yes.
How do you describe what the Wynwood Yard is, what you've done with that space in the time you've been there?
So the Wynwood Yard is a community hub and a culinary incubator. And what it is it's about 40,000 square feet of property that has evolved into this very dynamic temporary use space that's filled with food trucks and trailers and retrofitted shipping containers, a stage, the largest urban organic edible farm in Miami-Dade County, and a big bar in the middle. And it really is just a space to experience the best vibes in the city in a really beautiful open atmosphere.
A lot of music.
With live music 6 nights a week. And we do everything that we can to promote what's local in the entrepreneurial and arts and cultural realms in the city. So you can come there to experience local food, local music, local art, and local culture.
So what did you hear from people? What did you hear from musicians, artists, business owners? What did you hear from the community when this news came out?
Well, I guess I would want to take a step back and sort of say, like, why I even decided to start the yard in the first place was, and that was because I was hearing something from that community, which was that right now in Miami, it is very, very hard to enter into any kind of retail or cultural operation without tremendous capital expenses. And the issue with that is that we're basically creating very high areas to entry in our local economy for the arts and for people that are doing dynamic, innovative things in the retail space and aren't national retailers with huge opening budgets, operating budgets, marketing budgets. And so what I wanted to do when I got to Miami, I started having conversations with all of these cultural and culinary entrepreneurs, and I saw that there were so many barriers to access for them to even get to try out their craft in the local marketplace at a reasonable price point. And so I wanted to create a hub for them to be able to do that. Ultimately, I think, you know, there definitely has been an outcry of some sorts at the news that the Yard won't be there forever, which obviously, you know, is meaningful for us to the extent that we're happy that we've been able to make an impact and sort of change the trajectory of some of the entrepreneurs that have been there and their experience in Miami. And, you know, we know for sure, we have data to show that, you know, we've had over 200 entrepreneurs that have been involved in some capacity on the site, whether it's for a pop-up for one day or for running an operation there for 3 years. And we've seen, I think, I have to look at the numbers, but somewhere between 12 and 15 of them have actually been able to take that operation and then transition into a brick and mortar setting or scale up somewhere in Miami. And so,
but all of this is expected, right? Because it goes to the conversation about what Wynwood is.
Correct.
So, I mean, you know, you arrive and Wynwood is starting to build up.
I can't take credit for Wynwood. Wynwood was already way built up before
right.
I got
it,
there.
it still is building up, actually, and there's a lot of big projects in place. But, I mean, look, the history, not going deep into it, you know, this is a lot of industrial area at one point, and now all of a sudden it's this hub for, you know, the arts and for entrepreneurs and so forth. But eventually that's going to get built out, and you got to find another place. But, I mean, when you were coming up and coming into it, also, for people who've never been to Wynwood, what do you say to people about what Wynwood represents? What does it mean to the city of Miami and to a lot of these business owners?
So,
why is it such a unique place?
I think Wynwood is a tremendously unique place because of the creativity and the innovation that's allowed to flourish there. I think that we live in a society where oftentimes people just want to put something in a box, and Wynwood is the space where everything that's unconventional happens, and the wild ideas and the crazy ideas and the artistic, creative ideas are allowed to evolve there, and they get the recognition and the following that they need to gain steam and grow and develop. And to me, another really beautiful thing about Wynwood is just the sense of community. Definitely, there is a sense that there are a lot of entrepreneurs that are just kind of all just starting out on their journey and need a lot of support and there's a lot of co-creation and a lot of collaboration that happens between the community there. And so to me, there's always been this sense of a neighborhoody sense to Wynwood and the entrepreneurs that are driving that local economy. And that's something that I really hope can stay preserved in the neighborhood, even as it continues to evolve.
Okay. That's the question right there is that creativity, is that sense of community threatened by these big projects and that development and the vertical growth?
You know, it's a very good question.
With Wynwood Yard leaving, yes. O Cinema leaving, is that kind of the sign that it's threatened?
Look, my honest opinion on this is that it really depends on the landlords and the property owners and how they continue to curate. I know that, you know, there have been certain developers in Wynwood, and the two that I'll mention now for sure are David Lombardi and Goldman Properties, that have made a concerted effort over time to bring in tenants that heavily contribute to the artistic, creative, dynamic, and cultural nature of what the neighborhood is. And they have gone through great lengths to support those tenants, even when they had a higher bidder come in and would happily have paid them more for rent on a specific property. And so my view on that is that it really depends on landowners and landlords to continue to invest in the artistic and cultural aspects of the neighborhood. And that's really within their hands. So if they choose to bring in tenants that, you know, are going to pay the highest dollar but don't reflect the character of Wynwood, then that's what will happen to Wynwood. But if they choose to keep making strategic decisions to do the right thing to preserve what Wynwood can be and to let it evolve in an organic way, but to like hang on to the character, then that's how it will go.
I'm talking with Della Hyman, the founder and CEO of the Wynwood Yard. It was announced in early September Wynwood Yard and O Cinema Wynwood would be closing for the development of a new housing complex called Wynwood Green. Again, to mention, you're not closed yet. Some people have told...
Not even closed.
You've heard people say, oh, they're closed. I mean, does that hurt business?
Yeah, it's definitely had an impact on our business. So I would say the most important message that we're trying to get out right now is that not only are we not closed, but we're actually doubling down and reinvesting in incredible programming and culinary curation to move into the season for this year. And the yard is thriving. It's alive and well, and it's going to be, you know, the best 6 months that we've ever had there. So we hope that people will come out and join us and celebrate what we've all created as a broad community over the past 3 years.
What happens after this, though?
So we're working on some other projects, and
are you gonna move Wynwood Yard?
Well, we're gonna move aspects of the Wynwood Yard to other projects. One project we're going to be announcing soon. Another project is something that has been already covered in the local media and that we've been working on for quite a while now, which is North Beach Yard, which is an expansion of the Wynwood Yard concept in North Beach in collaboration with the city of Miami Beach. And it will be located on 81st and Collins on the West Lawn.
Your take on what Wynwood is becoming. What do you think it's going to look like in 5 or 10 years?
Because
when you came here, I mean, it was a certain thing and it attracted you.
Look, it definitely attracted me. And even in the time that I've been here, I've seen that a lot of the artists that I know that used to spend a lot of their time in the neighborhood and used to sort of see it as an extension of the work that they were doing have moved on, or they're not as involved in Wynwood. And I think that this is just sort of part of the story of the evolution of neighborhoods. But I really do hope that Wynwood, that the developers that are controlling the evolution of the neighborhood continue to put an emphasis on arts and culture as central tenets to what the neighborhood's values are, and to create the platforms and the budgets to allow these activities to continue, because I think that ultimately what they are is they're a representation of the neighborhood's soul. And it's a sad thing to see a neighborhood lose its soul. So I hope that doesn't happen in Wynwood. I definitely don't think that Wynwood has lost its soul.
Della Hyman, the founder and CEO of the Wynwood Yard. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, you can find more details about tonight's Halloween party at the Yard with trick-or-treating and a DJ, as well as all of the other events happening at the Wynwood Yard this winter season, by finding us on social media, whether on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to look at a murder in Wellington that happened 28 years ago. Why is it still relevant? Because they recently made an arrest. That's Sundial coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Again, we are doing the show today from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. By the way, happy Halloween. Well, sometimes justice can be delayed, but justice eventually arrives. That's a quote from the words of State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg. The case he's referring to is a 1990 murder of Marlene Warren from Wellington. The suspect in the case, Sheila Keene Warren, was arrested last year and brought to Florida to face charges. Yes, the suspect was arrested 27 years later. And the other thing about this murder is that Sheila Keene is suspected of having dressed up as a clown, walked up to the victim's house, and after Marlene Warren opened the door, Sheila suspected of shooting her in the face. Marlene died a couple days later. Now, the story is one of the unbelievable tales told in the newest season of one of the highest-rated podcasts on iTunes, Felonious Florida. It's a true crime podcast produced by the Sun Sentinel. We're joined now by Sun Sentinel reporter who worked on the story, Tanya Alanez, and the editor, Juan Ortega. Tanya and Juan, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louis.
Tanya, let me start with you. When were you assigned to this story? How did this come across your desk?
I'm the night cops reporter. I work a 3 to 11 shift. So the day that they announced Sheila's arrest a year ago, September 2017, I was the reporter that evening when the news release came out from Palm Beach Sheriff's Office that the arrest had been made. So
when you look through this story, and by the way, I have to actually just say this. I was living in Wellington. I was a junior in high school at Wellington High School when this murder occurred. But I'll talk about that part of it later. I remember this. It was a mind-blowing story. Uh-huh. But when you saw this story 27 years after it happened, I mean, what's going through your mind?
Well, first of all, we had covered it so extensively, I couldn't believe I'd never, ever heard a hint of it. It was so crazy. One, I just couldn't believe the clown aspect of it, much less the 27-year aspect of it when I first started reporting it.
Let's look back at the characters and the circumstances of this case. We're going to start with the victim and her husband, Marlene Warren and Michael Warren. Briefly, Juan, tell us about who they are, what their relationship was like at the time of death.
Well, you know, looking at the case, we decided to try to figure out as much as we could about them, the family, and the circumstances surrounding that. And, you know, that relied on, in part, on talking with people in their lives at the time who were either friends or acquaintances or coworkers. And Tanya, she's the one who spent months doing research and being able to reach out to a lot of these people in their lives who were willing to jog their memories and be able to bring to life everything that was going on back then in 1990 and the events that were leading up to that.
And Tanya, I mean, 27 years later, people move on, they can move away. What was it like trying to find a lot of the people that you talked to?
And people die.
And that too, yes.
Yeah, that's what came across a lot of, you know, when we first made a list of people, like, let's reach out to, you know, X, Y, and Z. A lot of those, you know, main people we thought would be the best, you know, voices to bring to the podcast. They were no longer around. They, you know, they had passed on. They'd moved away. The other challenge was this is still an open case, and it's an open murder case. And a lot of people didn't want to talk because of those aspects of it. And a lot of people didn't want to be associated with the people involved or this crime.
Yeah. Now let's come back though to this again, this relationship between Marlene and Michael. And then the third person in this triangle, Sheila Keene. I mean, what was happening around the time of the murder and the relationship these three people had with each other?
Well, it seemed like Marlene and Michael's relationship was, I don't know, not as close as they once been. You know, they've been married 20 years at this point, and it seems like his life is all about work. She's busy managing rental properties. He's not home a lot, long nights out, you know, just not around. And so it seems like there's unhappiness there. And then Sheila just shows up one day and bounds into the onto the car lot and into everyone's lives.
And this is the car lot that that Michael and Marlene owned. And that a relationship basically started between Sheila and Michael.
Yes. She came along with a friend of Michael's who was, he was an occasional repo man for him. So Sheila showed up with her husband at the time, and they were repossessing cars together for Michael. Eventually, her husband's out of the picture. She's repossessing cars on her own. She's kind of moving on in and kind of taking over at the car lot.
Juan, there's something interesting, too, about this story is the neighborhood where the attack took place. This is the Aero Club of Wellington, and it's basically the furthest west of Wellington you can go. And, it's a very unique community.
Yeah, exactly. And the first of two episodes, the first one debuted yesterday. You can download it at Apple Podcasts or anywhere. But in that first episode, we were able to speak with actually the one of the reporters for the Sun Sentinel who worked there in 1990. And, this predates the internet, obviously, or like being able to stay tuned with breaking news. And so he would just sit in the newsroom and listen to the crackle of the police scanners and heard about a shooting at this, as you said, you know, sleepy, exclusive community. And he knew, hey, this doesn't happen in Wellington. So he goes out there and sure enough, he starts hearing about the initial details of what's to be told, that, you know, this woman had been shot and it was someone dressed up in a clown costume. So from there, it just it stood out. And one of the other things that came about was like him, you know, wrangling with this idea about like how do you talk about a clown who killed someone? Like, is it a he? Is it a she? Ultimately, defaulting to calling the clown an it.
And as you describe in the podcast, in the episode of the podcast, is, you know, basically the Marlene opens the door. There's a clown that Marlene's son had overheard her saying, "Oh, look how nice," or something to that effect. And then all of a sudden, there's a gunshot. The clown, the suspect, walks back to the car and then drives away, even though a chase does ensue, gets away. There was a strange situation, and I actually didn't know this about the case until I heard your podcast, where Michael Warren had a conversation with an attorney that probably should have set off a lot of alarms. Tanya, what was that conversation?
Really pretty bizarre. Okay, Marlene's younger son, Joey, had gotten into some trouble, so they were in court to resolve a plea deal. And Michael's there, Marlene's there, Joey's attorney. After the hearing, Marlene and Joey are out of earshot. Michael, you know, inquires for some legal advice from the attorney and, you know, kind of quietly asks him, what would happen to a wife's estate if she were killed? And the attorney, you know, is taken aback and just thinks the question is nuts. Not only why would you ask that, but why would you ask that with your wife just down the hall? And, you know, he tells them, well, you know, if somebody other than the husband did it and they can't link it to the husband, well, the husband would get away and the estate would go to the husband.
Again, amazed that I had not heard about that until now, 27 years later.
Well, it got weirder.
I know it does. It does.
Yeah. The next question or the next bit of advice, the attorney just goes further to say, and the way you could really get away with it, or one could really get away with it, was if the killer were dressed up in a costume, you know, maybe something like a clown where you couldn't even tell gender, male or female.
We're talking with Tanya Alanez and producer Juan Ortega from the Sun Sentinel, talking about their podcast, Felonious Florida. It is now in season 2, and we're talking about one particular episode that focuses on a murder in Wellington that happened 28 years ago. The reason this murder has relevance today is the fact that a suspect was finally, within the last year, arrested. Remember, you can find Felonious Florida on iTunes or a lot of other different places as well. I'm curious why it took so long. I mean, after all this time, you know, did they have other suspects? Was there not enough evidence? Was just dressing up as a clown enough to hide, and police, law enforcement just couldn't make a move? Why did it take so long?
Well, that's episode 2. Gets all into the investigation.
And which is coming out when?
That comes out a week from yesterday.
Yes, okay. So Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Yeah. But as far as that goes, though, when this killing initially happened in 1990, and as was mentioned in the first episode, there was a call to the police that from an anonymous someone saying, you might want to take a look at Michael and Sheila. And, you know, the arrest that happened just within the past year was solely for Sheila. To which I believe she's pleaded not guilty to the murder charge, and Michael has not been charged in any of this. Even though the sheriff's office itself, without going into specifics, has said that, to quote a spokeswoman, a very, very active, still open investigation, suggesting that it's possible that more than one person is going to be ultimately charged.
And do we know right now, or unless it's in the podcast, what happened to Sheila Keene and where's Michael Warren right now?
Tune in next week, Tuesday, episode 2, and you'll find all that out.
I love it. Great teaser. By the way, of all things, it's coming out on Election Day. Good timing, right? Okay. You know what? I wanted to ask about the podcast. I mean, we had you guys on. Talking about the podcast when it first came out. We had you on Sundial to talk about this. And I wondered, you know, what were some of the lessons learned from that first season? It was a big success.
Yes, it was. We when we were initially working on the first season, you know, you go into any project excited about it, but at the same time wondering if anyone will listen. And the first season, it drew more than 2 million downloads, which raised our eyebrows. But to the same token, we did learn a lot from it. Like me personally, I came away thinking about, you know, make sure to have as many potential people reached out to initially on, better practices on how to record audio, which to me was just kind of like I'm learning for the first time as we go, you know, making sure to listen to ambient sounds. I remember like one interview from the first season, I sat in an office and I didn't realize that there was a grandfather clock in the corner, and I was just like, you know, beating myself up over the fact that I didn't even notice that until like I'm listening to the actual recording. But moreover, in addition to that, we've been more nuanced in storyboarding and laying out how we're going to present each episode and focusing on natural sounds. I know some episodes, you know, did incorporate a lot of that.
Right. Well, you guys are always welcome to come over and hang out with Radio Guys. We're, you know, we're good at that stuff. let me finish with this real quickly. Is I've noticed that newspapers are getting into the podcast business pretty hard. And I'm wondering, is this just where the industry is going, that we're now going to be doing more in-depth reporting and storytelling through podcasts? Tanya, what do you think about that?
I think it's definitely caught on. People like it. And, you know, the feedback we're getting, the number of downloads we're getting seems to indicate, yeah, that's a direction to go, you know, and it feels like something new.
Juan, what do you think?
Yeah, it's an exciting medium. I mean, you know, I think part of why we even started this is because we ourselves are enthusiasts of podcasts and how they're so available, right, while you're cooking or driving. So it's an extra opportunity to reach an audience.
Well, it is a fascinating podcast. Again, some of these crimes, to go back and look at these old crimes here in South Florida, this one, again, for me, because I lived not too far. Well, I lived in Wellington. I wasn't too far when this happened. It was just insane to see it come up again. Tanya Alanez, again, reporter with the Sun Sentinel, working on this story, one of the episodes for Felonious Florida, and the producer, Juan Ortega, joining us from the downtown studios. Tanya, Juan, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Louis.
And again, the Felonious Florida podcast, you can find it on iTunes or anywhere else. And their next episode, as they close out the story about the Wellington murder, will be next Tuesday. Well, still to come, we're going to look at 3 decades of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. All next, coming up on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For more than 30 years, Fort Lauderdale has welcomed some of the most compelling independent films from South Florida and around the globe. The 33rd Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival kicks off this Friday and runs the next 2 weeks with a wide array of films that include documentaries, thrillers, and inspirational stories of hope. One of the films being shown is by local filmmaker Richard Jackson. It tells the story of an Iranian woman who escaped the country with her family as the Gulf War was erupting. Her son was also diagnosed with a terminal illness, so she traveled to South Florida to get him the proper treatment.
You know, the disease your son has is very, very rare. Did you know what they're going to do to him? No. Do you have experience? They all said no. I said, did you have any patient like my son? They all die by infection. My son, very strong boy, and he knows how to fight. He's a fighter.
We spoke with the filmmaker Richard Jackson, as well as the director of the film festival, Gregory Von Hausch. The conversation started with Gregory explaining the evolution of the festival over the years.
When I got there in 89, they were showing relatively dark Canadian indies, and the audience is very small. You could fire a cannon and not hit anybody. And so I don't really think so. I think there were people there that had migrated down here from metropolitan areas in the Northeast and Midwest, and they had a history with film. We just hadn't unearthed them yet, and now we've got them in. We've cultured and nurtured an audience and cultivated one. So I think it's very strong.
I definitely think the spirit of independent filmmaking is alive and well, and in their opportunities like the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival have cultivated that environment. I've come across a lot of filmmakers, independent small features, different genres, and it is definitely alive and well down here, and it's refreshing. It's inspiring. It's motivating for me.
All right, Richard, your film Hope's Mission will be your debut at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. So tell us a bit about Hope's Mission.
For me, it was about the evolution of hope. When you have, for instance, a job or an opportunity or something in your pathway, you hope that things go one way, and there's a chance that it doesn't go in that direction. So what has to happen is that hope has to evolve. Otherwise, it fades away, and a piece of you is now gone or in limbo or what have you. So the struggles that this that my subject had to face were important to me in that they could knock a person down. However, that hope had to evolve for her in order for her to push forward and keep on. And I think that it's inspirational and something that hopefully gives somebody some pause to think about what motivates them and how they reshape their hope when they face their struggles.
And your main character you're talking about is Victoria Yusefi?
Yes, Victoria, yep.
You know, tell us, I mean, how did you know you wanted to tell this story?
When I met Victoria, she was making a copy of some article that she was featured in, and I was kind of glancing over her shoulder a little bit and getting a little bit of the information. And when we spoke, she said, all right, well, you know, here, I'll give you a copy of my book. Take a look at that and let me know what you think. And there were so many things that my eyes were open to: the struggle of an Iranian Jew, the concept of leaving everything that you knew growing up behind to come someplace else for a better opportunity. That's not a struggle that I know to that capacity, but I have some insight as far as moving, you know, away from everything that you knew, and the magnitude at which these rapid changes came at her just blew my mind. And I said, this is a story that I think more people need to see on a larger level.
And just briefly, tell us a little bit about her story.
Oh, absolutely. Victoria grew up in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. And, you know, the film deals with a little bit of what that structure was like. It was a different, very different time than what we know today and what's portrayed in the media. And from there, the Islamic Revolution, war with Iraq, and she decided to move for a better opportunity for her children. And once she immigrated to the States, her son was diagnosed with a blood disorder that took a very strong toll on their faith and on you know, just how they maneuvered through their daily life. So you have somebody that's in a new country who doesn't speak the language, who has to, you know, figure out how to just do the basics, and all these challenges that are coming at her. So it was just fascinating for me.
Something about you personally, I'd read you used to work at UPS, right?
I did. When I lived in New York, I worked at the UPS hub, and moving down here, I found an opportunity to work at a UPS store. So I managed a UPS store, which is where I first encountered Victoria. And working in the public, it gave me an opportunity to hear a lot of stories. And you start to become like Sam the bartender. You see the same people time and time again, and you're able to invest that time that we don't have on a daily basis to ask those questions that give you insight into who a person is and where they've been. So
how'd you make that transition from UPS manager to filmmaker? That's amazing.
As a UPS manager, I did the film stuff part time. They went hand in hand. And I saw an opportunity to make a little bit of an exit at step one foot out. And I just prayed on it and stepped out on faith and said, you know, show me something. Let me let something work. And sure enough, opportunities have come.
I'm speaking with Richard Jackson, director of the new independent documentary Hope's Mission. It follows the story of an Iranian woman who emigrated to South Florida with her family as one of her sons struggles with a rare illness. It's going to be screened at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival beginning November 2nd. Also joining me in studio is the festival's director, Gregory Van Hausch. Gregory, what are some of the barriers that prevent new filmmakers from getting into the festival circuit and, you know, getting the chance to excel as independent filmmakers?
Right now, I think it's just that there's so many people out there doing film because film's become so easy a film to access. And it's competition. We looked at over 1,200 films for this year's festival and picked around 174, I believe. So I think that competition is hard. And in Rich's case, I mean, documentaries that deal with somebody with a terminal illness and strife and all this, they're a hard sell for a festival director to say, hey, come sit in our festival and hear this plight. His film captured me immediately, and I was working at my computer while I'm watching it and could have easily not finished it, except it was so engaging, and he did such a wonderful job.
You talk about competition, and I'm curious, and Richard, jump in as well, is the world we live in today, yes, it allows for more people to create, but at the same time, there are a lot of different places now where you can put your movies out there. And I wonder if this is a challenge for you in getting audiences because, I mean, there's Netflix and Hulu and YouTube and Vimeo and all these other places. So there's more channels to put your stuff, but that also means there's more places for me to enjoy movies and I don't have to leave.
Exactly.
Leave home.
And we all work so hard at our jobs. And after in this concrete jungle that everyone lives in down here, they have to go from work back to home. It could be a trek of I don't know how many miles. And then they're tired. They have a glass of wine. They see their big plasma on the wall. They want to sit around in their underwear and just watch the news or watch an old flick or whatever. So yeah, there's a lot of competition for time. So we try to make our festival event oriented. We'll do something with music or fashion or food, get people from the community that are from those communities where they're around from around the world and try to make it a different experience and then have the filmmakers there, like Rich is going to be there and Victoria will be there. So afterwards, we'll engage them in conversation, dialogue, things that can't really happen in your home, at least not as accessible as they are.
Greg, let's talk about a couple of the other major films being screened at this year's event. The Art and Times of Frosty Myers. Tell us a little bit about Frosty Myers.
Frosty Myers. Well, I had no idea who Frosty Myers was. And I also run the St. Augustine Film Festival. So closing night of the St. Augustine Film Festival, we're in this old antebellum house that houses the Rat Party. And underneath the stairwell was this hippie-looking guy, and his wife was chatting my ear off about, oh, this is Frosty Myers and blah, blah, blah. We have this new film. And I've found in my travels anybody that talks a lot promoting themselves, I usually dismiss. So I'm like, okay, great. So months went by and she sent me the video and it is phenomenal. Frosty was a contemporary of Warhol's and all that art scene in New York. He did the first laser installation in the village working with NASA lasers way back in the early 60s. And it was just a unique, a sculptor, but he would work in all different kind of mediums. And I was watching this thing and I was just so enthralled with it. I was so excited to know that this old hippie that I met is Frosty Myers. So we're going to bring him up. We're going to show it at the Museum of Art and have a big party for him there. And that's on November 15th, Thursday, November 15th at 7 o'clock.
Richard, real quick, I'll end with you. You kind of touched on a little bit just a little while ago, but what is it you want people to experience? You know, you want to have the audience be there and have the opportunity to talk with you and Victoria afterwards. But what is it you want them to experience when they go?
I want them to experience the feeling of I found a hidden gem, whether it be my film or one about Frosty Myers or any of these films, just to feel like they're on the inside of something, that they're a part of a burgeoning history that's being made with people who are giving everything that they have. If any of these filmmakers that are out here are like myself, I know that they're giving everything that they can, not to appease some studio, but to appease themselves and to reach out to the public with something from their heart. And I hope that's what any person that comes to this festival or sees my film or any of these films walks away from, that this is somebody that's putting everything that they have, sometimes financially, literally, into making something so that you can be educated, informed, entertained, and just have a moment in that atmosphere of the theater.
And that was Gregory Van Hausch, the director of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. And you just heard Richard Jackson, the director of the film Hope's Mission. The film festival begins Friday, runs through November 18th. More information about film screenings and events available on our social media. Find us, WLRNSun.com. Well, that is the program for this Halloween Wednesday, October 31st. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. In the spirit of Halloween, you're listening to the theme of the 1978 classic starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Halloween. Have a safe holiday. Have a fun holiday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.